Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy today to be speaking with Tom Goldtooth, who is a director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. It's a national organization. It's based in Minnesota. And you're just telling me, Tom, that it seems like it's environmentally clean, but its appearances can be deceiving.
Yeah. Our office is at the headwaters of the Mississippi River. We're about 30 miles downstream. Bemidji is a small college and logging town that is the first town along the river. We have a lot of pulp and paper mills and a lot of industry involved with logging. In fact, Paul Bunyan and Babe statue is right across our offices, between our office and the lake shore of Lake Bemidji. And that's one of the legacies of this colonization and industrialization and raping and taking of our resources, this beautiful trees that we used to have, you know, our own headwaters, our own ancient forests up there, cedars and red pines, white pines, and everything's been devastated. Now we have a lot of softwoods, popple, and aspens that have taken over. In fact, is the dominant species now, which have choked out any potential of restoration of all the old white pines. You know, if there's going to be any restoration up there, you know, we're talking about a lot of human interaction, human intervention, which takes money. Of course, you know, the logging companies don't have that money. The state doesn't have that money, and in fact, they thrive on this new monoculture of softwoods now. The whole industry there, in fact, has been retrofitted, you could say, mm-hmm. to accommodate softwoods. You know, the paper mills are, you know, and the chipboard, oxboard industry are all dependent on that. That's where all the money has been rechanneled into that kind of logging enterprise. So it doesn't really allow the restoration of our old forests. You know, and I'm here to speak here, in fact, at the Bioneers Conference, and some of my discussion is talking about indigenous knowledge, biojustice, or biological injustice, I should say. You know, how we're dealing with serious issues here on this planet once again. You know, but I think, you know, we're at this crossroads that I talked about, in fact, some time ago with you. You know, it's really manifesting itself now in this frenzy for retaliation and violence and war, which perpetuates this militarization, you know. And as indigenous peoples, we've been very, very knowledgeable of this militarization, the whole conquest, mentality of conquest 500 years ago in the Americas. Had devastated millions and millions of indigenous peoples of this continent in our Holocaust. So biodiversity is a serious issue here that I'm going to be talking about, and we're looking at an area at the headwaters of the Mississippi that has been devastated from its natural beauty, its inherent beauty that the Creator gave us. And so that's what I'm going to, you know, some of the things I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, I think, 90% or 95% or something like that of the trees in the United States or the planet or something have been cut down. I mean, just about all the trees in the world have been cut down, I have the impression. And I just want to ask real quick, what is it a bad thing to have this softwood? At least there are other trees planted. I'm just wondering about that.
Well, this is something that I believe our civil society, the public, really needs to be involved with these questions. Because a lot of these, the answers to these questions like that aren't transparent to people, whether it's our indigenous leadership, our tribal governments, our tribal citizens, our non-native people out there, the listening audience. You know, we're not plugged in because the system doesn't allow us to be plugged in. But that's a good question. You know, we have to really look at these things from a societal perspective, looking at the economic systems that have been created to depend on this type of industry. You know, are there alternatives? And I believe that there are alternatives that we have to look at. For an example, one of the issues that we're dealing with now in our network is the issues of persistent organic pollutants, chemicals that go into an environment that do not break down. They bioaccumulate in the environment, in the fat tissue of the fish and wildlife, and even into the soils. We're finding a lot of concentrations of dioxin, for an example, which is the byproduct waste of the chlorine industry. You know, this stuff is going into our bodies as indigenous peoples. And studies have just come out the past 10 years on this. There's dioxin campaigns nationwide and internationally. There's a movement to eliminate these silent poisons, as we call it. And it's going into the wildlife, into the environment of the Arctic Circle. That's where these chemicals drift to. And, you know, as indigenous peoples, you know, we have high concentrations of this stuff from the breast milk of the Mohawk woman in the eastern Great Lakes to the Inuit woman in the northern territories. Loon eggs that have 10,000 parts per million of PCBs. You know, Fox River in Wisconsin has high levels of PCB contamination from the paper sludge of years ago. And, you know, the technology now, we have no method of cleaning up and remediation of these things. And the goal is to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. But again, those are things that, you know, we all like to have white paper. But in order to have white paper, we need to bleach it out with chlorine.
Yeah, well, and just having... anyway, I don't want to disturb your thought there. We're getting a little distracted. We're sitting on the ground outside, which is the best we can do, which is very nice, but a little noisy by these pines. Yeah, I would just want to say about dioxin, that is such a horrible, horrible thing, and PCBs that are affecting all of us, of course, and all the animals, and including humans. It's such a horrendous degree, and most people don't really even seem to know anything about it, because I actually bring that up often. I say, don't put hot things in plastic, and most people are totally unaware.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we've become a synthetic. We've become a synthetic, you know, community, a synthetic world. Mm-hmm. Again, we have to look at how industry has created this situation. You know, so that we're not in touch with it. So that means when policies are developed, you know, we're not plugged into that. You know, it's very hard nowadays too, especially right now where we're at with this whole militarization. You know, and my fear is that this frenzy right now is going to lead towards it's going to lead to more blackouts in the media. It's going to create more scrutiny of those organizations out there that have been trying to address these issues. You know, funding that has been earmarked for non-governmental organizations and nonprofits to do a lot of this work now is starting to dry up and be reshifted mm-hmm. from this state that we're in right now. You know, a lot of them, those families that donate money in philanthropy depend on stocks. So the stocks go down, less money goes out to these nonprofits doing this kind of work.
Plus, which probably the people that donate to positive causes like the indigenous Environmental Network probably don't have stocks in like weapons manufacturing companies, which are the ones that are making the money.
Yeah, that's right. You know, some of the things that, you know, we have to say through forums like this Bioneers Conference here in San Rafael is that we have to really rethink what our relationship is to the sacred. And that sacred is our Mother Earth and our Father Sky. We have to reevaluate what that is. All society has to do that because we've been so industrialized, and through that industrialization process, you know, we've been removed from the land so that we don't know what that responsibility is to the land. And that's why it's extremely important for people, whether they live in an urban environment or rural environment, to really try to refocus on what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's becoming, well, it has been for a while. It's just going from bad to worse, the environment, all these issues. And I want to say to people, for sure, there's more constriction of the media, which wasn't so good to begin with. So if you don't hear more programs like this, you can know why it is. I also want to ask you, Tom Goldtooth, what are a couple things. I want to talk about the conference in South Africa, and I also want to hear about the particular projects that the Indigenous Environmental Network is focusing on right now.
Well, we took a delegation to Durban, South Africa, for the World Conference Against Racism, and there were two priorities that we wanted to work on. One was to continue to support the effort of many indigenous non-governmental organizations who have been working on putting forward demands for the recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples within the international community, especially within the United Nations forums. There's a working group of indigenous peoples who have been working on this for 17 plus years. And so a lot of the elders that have been working in that were there, and we supported them in that effort. Our other agenda as the Indigenous Environmental Network is to push forward language within the NGO forum that was being held parallel, as well as the governmental conference of this meeting against racism, to deal with racism issues, is to put to create understanding of what environmental racism is, that and also to make sure that there's strategic language in both documents of the NGO and the government language that not only recognizes that there is racism in environmental regulations and laws that are created, and the whole way that we as industrialized countries, and also the impact to third world and developing countries on how natural resources and territories of indigenous peoples are taken, where the rights of indigenous peoples aren't recognized, to where those lands are contaminated and destroyed, for an example, in the Amazon South in South America, we have thousands and thousands of acres of land that have been devastated from mining, from gold mining, and the social impacts and economic impacts to those once thriving and healthy communities have been completely destroyed, you know, and that there's racism in that. And so that was our main mandates that we worked on when we were there, and we were quite successful. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy, though, because we were also educating our own non-governmental organizations that are usually allies, putting forth our own agenda. That is environmental racism that they need to embrace too. I mean, there's people there pushing prisoners' rights, gender issues, you know, across the whole spectrum of various racism. But we were quite successful educating our NGO family. In the final text that came out, we have substantial language in there that addresses the issues, but also a program of actions on what needs to be done. So within the listening audience, you know, we ask that you know go to Google or some search engine, find the World Conference Against Racism, and in the NGO document, there's some really good language for the public, for nonprofits, for people who are activists, people who are concerned. Work that language. That gives a mandate of people who came to Durban, you know, from civil society that demanded change. You know, we don't just want something, a chocolate covering or something. We're asking for systemic change. That's what we're looking for nowadays, you know. And that's what we said in the NGO forum. Of course, it was more challenging in the government forum, but I didn't have that much expectations. United States has been most resistant to international language addressing environmental racism. That was very evident in a lot of the pre-sessional meetings, the preparatory meetings that were held prior to Durban. Our delegation that went all reported that there was tremendous resistance from the United States State Department on environmental racism language. In fact, they were successful at getting England, the UK, to do interventions into protests on language of indigenous peoples as well as this environmental racism, while U.S. took a back seat and didn't, you know, well, you know, we think that was part of U.S.'s plan. They already got they experienced a lot of damage control from the Kyoto protocols internationally. If you go international, you read a lot of the international newspapers and you see that there's a lot of negativity against the United States. And so in this World Conference Against Racism, they were very concerned about their image, especially with this issue of how to deal with Zionism, with all the millions of dollars of money that we pump into Israel, for an example, and what's happening to the Palestinians. And that was a big issue over there. Daily demonstrations. And it was something that needed to be addressed as well. And I don't think the United States wanted to be in that public eye as there were discussions on that issue. So, of course, they came and gone. But as United States-based indigenous NGO, we felt that the United States need to be represented. In fact, I made a statement when I was over there, you know, that it's ironic that we as the First Nations, we as the Aboriginal people of this continent, of the United States, we were here first, that in these international meetings that there's no representation of our Native people in a formal relationship, that the people who are representing me, the people who are representing our network and our constituencies of traditional leadership, our tribal leadership that's out there, our communities, our elders, who's representing us is the colonial system. And we're dealing with some hard issues that's on the line. Climate change and its impact to our subsistence culture, our people up in Alaska, for an example, where the ice is thinning. It's affecting their life up there, their human rights to exist. The whole energy plan of Bush, for an example, and his energy plan is demanding opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And I've been up to Arctic Village. I've talked to those elders and those hunters, and we're sitting on the ground like I am here, talking to these people who still practicing the subsistence way, and we're saying that a lot of people out there don't understand the seriousness of this. They use science, in fact, to justify continued destruction, saying that, well, this is not going to be much damage here when we put it in this oil platform. But even the pounding and the drilling into that part, even the pounding and the drilling in that area that they're going to drill at, which is over 100 miles away, is felt and heard by the caribou. When you're standing and sitting on that earth, you can feel that. It's going to scare the caribou. It's going to affect the mothers who are birthing. And there's that spiritual essence of that's going to be affected. That's something that the Western society doesn't understand. And that's one of the things I want to talk about here is indigenous knowledge indigenous knowledge is understanding what their relationship is to the land. Not just indigenous people, but the non-native people as well. A friend of mine that passed on a couple of years that also did this kind of work that I do, Walter Persett from Wisconsin. He used to attend a lot of these non-native gatherings, and he would tell these room of white people, and he'll say, you know, why is it that I have to bear responsibility for protecting this earth? I'm tired. I'm tired of doing this. It's your responsibility, you know, that your ancestors immigrated here. Take care of our land. That's all I ask. Take care of our land. Protect it. Protect it like I want to take care of it, because you are native to this land now. You have been born here. Your people came here many generations ago. Now you might have to inherit this. You have to inherit this responsibility now. Please do that. And that's something that I've been really thinking about. Of course, as indigenous peoples, we have certain rights here that we've been fighting for and still struggling for. We don't want the abrogation of our treaties, you know? And we need to still work for that. And our network is right there on the front lines demanding recognition of our treaty rights. We have First Nations rights. But at the same time, though, we are living here with a lot of people who have immigrated here, whether they wanted to or not. You know, a lot of African people weren't brought here because they wanted to. They were brought here by slavery. Now we have a lot of people who are mixtures of indigenous and European bloodlines. Look at the Latino and the Latina. They are a majority here in the California where I am. Mm-hmm. They have indigenous bloodline in them. So we've been networking a lot with the Chicano, the Latino community. There's been a lot of them that have been going back to the indigenous ways and re-identifying as well. We worked with a lot of white people as well, re-identifying their relationship to the land, African American people, Asian people. You know, we have to do that.
Well, we're all on the same planet, that's for sure. And it always, it's just so incredibly stupid to spoil our own nest. And for Native people, you just get it from every side. It's just like you got to fight for every inch of the way, it seems.
That's right. You know, some of the things we're doing in our network, you know, we are a community-based organization. We have board members who are representatives of various organizations. One of those organizations we work with here in California is the California Indians for Cultural and Environmental Protection. They live down in Southern California. Los Coyotes Reservation, Santa Isabel, Cahuilla, you know, there's pockets of these communities that are impacted now from urban sprawl. You know, for an example, Cahuilla is, their community is experiencing illegal dumping from petroleum contaminated soils. You know, these gas stations that have leaking underground tanks, and that soil that's piled there waiting to be hauled out. Somehow truckers and the people who are in the business of hauling that stuff out are taking it to Indian lands, stock, you know, just dumping it in the back 40. You know, why is it that our Indian people have to, you know, be dumped on once again, you know? So we do a lot of work throughout the country. I'm just the eyes and ears of a lot of community people that are doing this work. We try to elevate the issues. Over 10 years ago, our grassroots and our elders and our youth said, we need to have some sort of a network, an organization that would be an advocate for us, would be that spokesperson for us, and help create venues and meetings where we can bring our communities, like Sarah James, for an example, helping Sarah James from Quich Inn Arctic Village to go out on these tours, speaking tours throughout the world in this country, talking about why we need to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. People like Margene Bull Creek at Skull Valley Goshutes in Utah, where a consortium of 8 nuclear power utilities from back east, including one of ours in Minnesota, formed a business partnership with her tribal council over money to dump nuclear waste there. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to work with these issues. They're very, very complex issues, and that across many jurisdictions and political systems that have been imposed on us, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Indian Health Service, HUD, EPA, our own tribal systems. But we've been pretty, I think we've been pretty really effective in everything we've been doing because it's grassroots based. Giving information to our community who never had this information before. And our tribal governments, over 10 years ago, we had a situation where most tribal governments did not have environmental protection programs in place. There was no one watching the shop back home. That's why private industry was coming and taking advantage of this scenario where there wasn't any tribal standards on permitting and siting of industries. Our own environmental assessment studies, for an example, where we can incorporate traditional values. I mean, this is what we've been working on the past 10 years, is also helping our tribes to understand their responsibilities in this modern context, to build these infrastructures of tribal codes, tribal laws to protect our lands, and to challenge EPA and BIA, get this money to our tribes. Get it to our tribes, you know, help them develop these programs, get our tribal environmental staffers hired. So, you know, we've been doing a lot of this at many different levels.
So you feel that Tom Goldtooth, that it really has been success, you have been successful, because, well, we only have a couple minutes left now, but I just hear one horrendous story. I mean, I'm closer to the news than most people are, so... I hear just one horrendous story after the other. And so many people think that issues of Native Americans are kind of over with, you know, that I don't know. It is amazing, but a lot of people think that. And of course, the issues that you're talking about in the environment are things that affect, many of them affect all of us. But like you say, it's like nuclear waste gets dumped in Native territory. I mean, it's kind of more focused. Still, the battle, the struggle continues, and the targeting of Native people continues.
That's right. You know, and now, like at this Bioneers, you know, I have to bring up on how they're targeting our bodies, our genes, our cell lines, and they're patenting that. This colonial attitude where they took our land, we went through a process, even they commodified the sacred, our songs, our ceremonies, and now they're patenting our whole body, you know, seed knowledge, and these are things that we're addressing here. So these are very important issues, you know, that, I mean, this affects everyone, you know, and our indigenous peoples worldwide, there's little pockets of these communities still practicing the traditional indigenous thought, that thinking, subsistence, and that's where they're at. But this whole idea of how we define progress and development, you know, it's really destructive to a lot of our communities. And we're trying to turn this around, like decolonization, some training on what that is as indigenous peoples. We're looking at systemic change. We're looking at doing things a lot different because we know what the issues are. But and bringing our youth into this movement that we're doing, you know, we have a really dynamite youth program, the Native Youth Movement that's been emerging. That's part of our youth network right now. They're out there, they're engaged, they're out there demonstrating, doing the actions, and in Canada, New Brunswick, and Canada, and British Columbia, and then right here in the Bay Area, there's a Native Youth Movement that's been meeting.
Great. Well, if you would, Tom Goldtooth, give the contact information for the Indigenous Environmental Network, any way to get hold of you if people want to know more. Do you have a web page or phone number?
We do have a web page. It's www.ienearth.org. We're also a project of Seventh Generation Fund right up the coastline in Arcata. That's www.7thgeneration.org as well. And that'd be the best place to get a hold of us, email, phone number, whatever.
Uh-huh. Okay. Give the webpage one more time.
ienearth.org.
Okay. ienearth.org. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tom Goldtooth, Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, which is based in Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and my name is Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.